a trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. I want you to know something about this program, and that is my goal is not to build the largest, most loyal listening audience in history. Now, that may sound like a cop-out or it may sound counterproductive. Well, why else would you want to do this sort of thing? And the answer is simply this. I'm speaking to that remnant of people out there, however big or however small it is, who still value truth above comfortable lies or above the assurance from people who are trying to rule them that everything is fine. This is fine. This is normal. Adjust your chains and move on. This is exactly as things are supposed to be. Chances are the fact that you're even listening to this means you already understand. No, it's not fine. It's not the way things were intended to be. And it doesn't matter if there is, you know, if our listening audience consists of the same five individuals who've been my core listeners for the last 25 to 30 years. Nope. It's about the fact that the truth still needs to be spoken because there are still people who are seeking it. And if I can confess something to you, I don't know how big my audience is or isn't. In fact, I don't spend time obsessing. Oh, did I get more listens? Is there more? What's the audience? What are the numbers? What are the numbers? I don't care. And I'm not being arrogant here because I just know that, you know, that my message is so important that, of course, people are going to find it. I understand. This is not a message that's going to resonate for everybody. Some people are just not ready to hear the kind of things that I will share on this program. That's totally okay. In fact, if you're one of those people and you're going, all right, well, I gave it a shot. It's just not my cup of tea. That's fine. But there are people out there who are actively looking for the truth, unsure what to make of all that's going on around us, and just looking for not so much someone to tell them what to think, but looking for some credible, timely, principle-based information on which they can continue their search for truth. So I give you the best information that I can find. I leave it up to you as to what you will do with that, whether you incorporate it into your life or just, all right, nod and say that was interesting, but maybe it doesn't really add that much to your vantage point. It's all about thinking clearly and independently. And never is that more important than during times of crisis, which I think it's pretty safe to say we're living in a time of crisis. So let's dive into another great topic here. I have a lot of different resources. In fact, on my website, thebrianhydeshow.com, I have a page specifically dedicated to resources for wrong thinkers. And these are some of the better news aggregators and different publications and platforms that seem to have attracted voices of reason that can cover difficult topics without devolving into name-calling or spittle-flinging or otherwise just going off on some kind of an ideological tirade. Intellectualtakeout.org is one of those great resources. And I like to check them on a daily basis because I can always find something that's relevant and it's also extremely thoughtful. Case in point. This is the latest from Annie Holmquist, How to Raise Kids Who Don't Have Daddy Issues. The takeaway from this one is today's society does a good job of insinuating fathers are worthless and unnecessary, but Annie Holmquist says nothing could be further from the truth. So, you probably heard the phrase, she's got daddy issues. Usually said with a roll of the eyes or a heavy sigh, the phrase daddy issues signals that an adult, often a female but sometimes a male, has trouble forming solid relationships. And this problem is attributable to the fact that a person didn't have a great relationship with his or her father as a child. Given the rate of broken homes and children being raised by single parents in recent decades, things are ripe for a large portion of the population to have daddy issues. In fact, daddy issues may be a reason why we see so much anger, anxiety, loneliness, and even a decline in marriage and childbirth rates in our nation. Annie Holmquist asks, so how can today's young men ensure that they don't raise children with daddy issues? Or how can today's young women ensure that they're marrying a man who won't give their children daddy issues? In other words, how do we make sure the next generation is raised by good fathers? Well, Annie says, drawing upon my own childhood as someone who was blessed to be raised by a good father, I have a few ideas that any man can implement to become a good dad. I thought she had some really good ones here. Number one, play with them. She says, the time I remember playing with my father, the time I most remember playing with my father happened once a month when Mom left for a regularly scheduled monthly event. Inspired by Little House on the Prairie books, we played Mad Dog, with Dad racing around on his hands and knees and growling and chasing my sister and me while we ran around the dining room table screaming. We pulled out the Lincoln logs and blocks together, building houses for our little Fisher-Price people. We sat on Dad's shoulders as he raced around the house, giving us the thrill of ducking to narrowly missed door frames. Now, such roughhousing would be frowned upon in today's bubble-wrapped culture. But she says fathers who engage in such behavior with their children not only create fond memories, but they also provide a needed sensory experience, adding a child's muscle sense and other balance-related issues, or aiding the muscle sense and balance-related issues. Such play can also have neurological-related benefits, releasing valuable hormones such as oxytocin and dopamine. Just as an aside, I think she's right. I think back to some of the fondest memories of childhood, and, surprisingly, they weren't when I was required to go pick up the dog poop from the yard or clean up the apples that had fallen off our apple tree. They were the times when my dad would roughhouse with me and my sisters. And it was just mindless roughhousing, rolling around on the living room floor, and we were always amazed at how strong he was, but, yeah, that was actually some of the best part of childhood. Secondly, she recommends be patient. Children get into enough mischief or naughtiness to easily provoke any father, yet resisting the urge to give in to such anger and display it in front of his children should be a high priority for dads. The patient kindness of her own father made her far less afraid to approach him with problems or difficulties, and the father who can maintain such open communication is far less likely to raise children with the daddy issues that cause heartache to the child and society at large. This next recommendation also strikes home. Read to them and tell them stories. She says, Dad read a range of books to us, including advanced novels such as Anne of Green Gables and George MacDonald's The Prentice and Curdie, and easy readers such as the now non-politically correct Dan Frontier series. But he didn't stop with that. He also made spin-offs, spoofing Dan Frontier books with characters from our neighborhood, and created his own stories. Maddie's Island was a long-running serial spun from his mind. Not every father's going to be a storyteller like hers was, but she says pretty much any father can read, and reading out loud to children helps them with vocabulary, comprehension, and increased interest in reading, thus building a foundation for future success in school. Reading out loud is also linked to a decrease in behavioral issues such as aggression or hyperactivity. Next, she recommends love their mother. Now, this is probably the oldest advice in the book, but that's probably because it's true. If children see their father loves, protects, cares about, and provides for their mother, then they gain the security needed to freely live and enjoy life, unstifled by the worry of a broken home or abandonment. Such security will follow them into adulthood, enabling them to better enter positive relationships and relationships that mirror the positive one they saw between their father and mother. Okay, last one, follow God. She says one of the best ways to be a good father is to know the best father of all, God. Those fathers who know him on a personal level, learning his kind, patient, gracious, and just nature, will then be able to mirror such character to their own children. And the more those children are connected with that heavenly father via their earthly one, the less chance there will be of forming the instability and insecurity in life that so characterizes daddy issues. Annie Holmquist says today's society does a good job of insinuating that fathers are worthless and unnecessary, but nothing could be further from the truth. The more good men there are who step forward to raise their children right, the fewer lost, lonely, and adrift young people with daddy issues will have. Now, I've got a link to this in the show notes, and I want to add one quick annotation here. Something that I've personally observed and that, to me, earns my deepest respect. And that is, I realize that not every family is in a perfect situation. There are families that are broken. There are families that have had to deal with divorce. I have personally known a number of fathers who have literally gone to the ends of the earth to be a part of their children's life, even if the marriage to the kid's mother had ended. And they did it without being belittling or still, you know, being combative towards their ex-spouse. They put those kids first. Sometimes they had to uproot and move themselves, you know, hundreds of miles or thousands of miles to be a part of their kid's life. That's something that commands respect. And it bespeaks a selflessness that I think pays great dividends in helping to raise good children in less than ideal circumstances. So take that for what it's worth. We'll be back right after these messages.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Want to give some recognition to Dixie Chiropractic, one of my great sponsors. That's Dr. Ward Wagner. They're located in St. George, Utah. And specifically, Dr. Wagner has asked me to reach out to those in my audience who might be dealing with car accident injuries or bulging herniated discs or neuropathy. All of these can involve pain. All of these are things that he and his office can help with. You can go to DixieChiro.com to get full details on these things. But specifically, for those with bulging herniated discs, ask about the $99 intro special, which consists of two treatments plus massage. Just reach out to Dixie Chiropractic at DixieChiro.com. Or for neuropathy, ask about the $99 Calmare treatment plus massage. Again, DixieChiro.com will put you in touch with them. When you're making your appointment, please let them know you heard about Dixie Chiropractic on this program. So how bad do various authoritarians want to exert control over you and your children? Now, you probably know the answer is pretty bad. It's real bad. In fact, as Kerry McDonald explains, it's bad enough for MSNBC to claim that homeschooling is driven by insidious racism. Check this out. On Friday, MSNBC shared a tweet claiming homeschooling is being driven by the insidious racism of the American religious right. Well, Anthea Butler, the opinion columnist who wrote the article referenced by the tweet, never used that specific phrase. Her piece implies that homeschooling is a strategy used by white evangelical parents to destroy public schooling and uphold racial segregation. The tweet actually says, it may seem harmless, but the insidious racism of the American religious right's obsession with homeschooling speaks volumes, writes Anthea Butler. Now, the facts, including those which Butler acknowledges in her article, simply do not reflect her theory. Kerry McDonald says Butler, a professor of religious and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania, asserts that homeschooling originated out of the work of Christian fundamentalist Rusas Rushduni in the 1960s. But she neglects to mention that the rise of the modern homeschooling movement was broad and bipartisan, capturing both the political left and right, who were equally dissatisfied with public schooling and other American institutions at the time. As education professor and author of Homeschool in American History, Milton Gaither writes, quote, given this pan-ideological commitment to local, authentic, private life and contempt for establishment liberalism, it's not surprising that members of both the countercultural right and the countercultural left reacted for different reasons against the 20th century expansion of public education into a near universal experience. End quote. Now, Butler goes on to claim that conservative Christian ideology continues to negatively influence today's homeschoolers, even as she admits the recent increase in homeschooling is coming from non-white, non-evangelical families. She gives a nod to the U.S. Census Bureau data showing that the independent homeschooling rate more than doubled in 2020 to 11.1% of the U.S. K-12 school-age population. Now, some of that increase may be attributed to black parents and other diverse groups who are now finding homeschooling as an attractive alternative, writes Butler. According to the Census Bureau, the number of black homeschoolers increased fivefold between spring and fall of 2020, from 3.3% to 16.1%. Black children were overrepresented in the homeschooling population compared to the overall K through 12 public school population. Carrie McDonald says the Census Bureau also found that much of the recent homeschooling growth occurred in areas that would not be considered religious or politically conservative. For example, she says the Boston-Cambridge area where she lives and homeschools her children saw homeschooling increase from 0.9% to 8.9% in 2020. Recent data analyzed by the Associated Press show that the homeschooling rate remains at record high levels this academic year. Now, this is even as schools are open for full-time, in-person learning, suggesting that many new homeschooling families enjoy the freedom and flexibility this educational approach offers. Fortunately, even parents and onlookers who may be indifferent to homeschooling, including some who identify as being on the left politically, can see through MSNBC's false assertion that insidious racism is motivating modern homeschoolers. For instance, in response to the MSNBC tweet, "It may seem harmless, but the insidious racism of the American religious right's obsession with homeschooling speaks volumes." This is from NYC Angry Mom, who says, "A lot of liberals, such as myself, felt incredibly disoriented during the Trump administration because of the blatant, easily verifiable lies that were jammed down our throat. I feel that way now about the current left-wing media. This is pure propaganda, not aligned to the facts." She goes on to say, in response to a tweet about how it's not just white families who are moving to homeschooling. 9.7% of white families with kids have pulled out of traditional education, as have 12.1% of Hispanic families, 8.8% of Asian families, and 16.1% of black families. And this NYC angry mom says, "I'm completely dispassionate about homeschooling, but when you look at the actual numbers, this uptrend in homeschooling doesn't appear to be driven by racism or religiosity." Imagine that. Carrie McDonald says, "Indeed, the most recent federal data on why parents choose homeschooling revealed that concern about the environment of other schools, including safety, drugs, and negative peer pressure, is the top motivator. Only 16% of homeschooling parents in the nationally representative sample chose a desire to provide religious instruction as their top motivator." Of course, even if religious instruction was the top motivator of today's homeschooling families, that wouldn't be a reason to criticize homeschooling or call those doing it racist. She says the response to MSNBC's tweet was swift and severe, with most comments and shares expressing outrage over the article and MSNBC's social media interpretation. Some voiced concern that there will now be calls for a ban on homeschooling, but these calls have been around for years. Carrie McDonald reminds us, back in June of 2020, she debated Harvard Law School professor Elizabeth Barthollet, who called for a presumptive ban on homeschooling. Now, these calls for homeschooling bans are not new, and they will persist, but as more families choose homeschooling and more resources such as micro schools and hybrid schools emerge to support homeschoolers, calls to ban homeschooling will continue to be ignored. Homeschooling is here to stay, driven by a demographically, geographically, and ideologically diverse group of families who share a common goal of wanting to take a more active role in their children's education. Media companies and academics can claim homeschooling is being chosen for nefarious reasons, but the facts simply don't support it. It's so interesting to me, because back before my wife and I even had kids, we became friends with a number of homeschoolers. In fact, at the time, we were living in southern Idaho and became friends with a family that had moved to Idaho from, I believe, South Carolina. One of the reasons they gave for moving to Idaho from clear across the country was because their state at the time, South Carolina, had a very antagonistic attitude toward homeschoolers. I mean, it was just like one step above, "Whoa, what are you doing? Is this about child labor? Are you, what's going on here?" They wanted, you know, absolute oversight in everything. Idaho, on the other hand, was very friendly to homeschoolers. And these parents made no bones about, you know, "We moved here because we felt we had a better chance to homeschool our kids." Now, that was well over a quarter century ago. In that time, I have personally seen homeschooling become much more mainstream, much more broadly accepted. And having actually been on the practicing end of it, I can tell you, It's a wonderful experience for those who choose to avail themselves of it. Now, I'm not suggesting everybody should do it, because frankly, there are some kids who respond in a more structured environment. Sometimes the government school provides that environment for them. And I think Carrie McDonald would back me up on this one. She is definitely an advocate for educational choice. Let parents decide what is best for their kids. Oh, sure, those parents aren't professional educators. But I think they actually outrank the professional educators in terms of those parents have a direct accountability to their children and to God. And I think the vast majority of them take that pretty seriously. So stay out of their way. Let them teach their kids as they feel best.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Welcome back to the show. And once again, let me just take a moment here to thank you for being part of our audience. Thank you for reveling in wrongthink, questioning the narrative, and accompanying me on this journey off the mainstream path and into a little bit more productive paths as far as finding truth. I want to thank lifesavingfood.com for being one of my sponsors and providing my listeners with a great resource that gets more timely with every passing day. If you haven't been to their website, I've got a handy link right there in my show notes. I would encourage you, check it out for yourself. You don't have to buy a whole full year's supply at one time. You can just, you know, buy a little bit here, a little bit there, but it adds up. And the time to do it was, of course, 10 years ago or yesterday, or you could start today. But putting it off really won't be an option for a whole lot longer. So maybe get a move on, click on the link, see if there's something that you need. And if you find out that there is, I would ask you, consider doing business with lifesavingfood.com. Speaking of food, got my hands dirty last night as we sat down and planted about half of our garden. Now, I'm very fortunate. My in-laws have a very nice, large gardening plot. I'm thinking it's like 50 by 25 or 30 feet. It's a good-sized plot. And we laid out the sprinkler system for it last week. We have planted, you know, tomatoes and peppers and other things yesterday. And we have more that we're going to be planting this weekend. So this is the year that I'm discovering the joy of growing my own food. I wonder if anybody else within earshot is doing this. Are you finding yourself contemplating the idea of producing more of your own food? See, Simon Black has some thoughts on the coming food crisis. By the way, he puts that in quotation marks. And he advises that developing those gardening skills is never a bad idea. But about that coming food crisis, he's got some very interesting thoughts. He says, on Wednesday, July 3rd, in the year 1315, King Louis X of France, also known as Louis the Headstrong, issued a groundbreaking edict. Whereas, according to the natural right, everyone should be born free, he began, many persons amongst our common people have fallen into the bonds of slavery, which much displeaseth us. That's not easy to say. Our kingdom is called and named the Kingdom of the Franks, which means free in Old French. Therefore, I do decree that such serfdom be redeemed to freedom. And like that, with the stroke of a quill, Louis X abolished slavery and serfdom in France. Unfortunately for the serfs, the king's emancipation didn't last very long. Louis died less than a year later following a particularly grueling tennis match, true story, and his successors weren't so liberal. More than four centuries later, in fact, in the mid-1700s, there were still more than 1 million feudal serfs in France, according to historian Hippolyte Taine. And their plight was even worse than their medieval ancestors. An 18th-century serf in France was subject to feudal dues of at least 14% to his local nobleman. Plus, there were a host of other absurd regulations. A French serf was tied to the land and unable to leave without his lord's consent. They were required to provide several weeks of free labor to the government, and any serf who died without children had all of his possessions forfeited to the nobility. On top of this tax, the French serf was required to pay a 10% tithing to the church, and on top of that, The national government also imposed taxes. There was a 5% national income tax, a national ad valorem tax on personal possessions, and national sales taxes on common goods like salt. The French government had also created an army of tax collectors who were authorized to forcibly enter people's homes to search for hidden wealth and arbitrarily seize their property in the case of any suspected tax evasion. This is how the word peasant became synonymous with poor person, because peasant is derived from the French word peasant, which literally meant civilian in Old French. It wasn't until the 1700s when French citizens, the peasants, were taxed into destitution that the term added its impoverished meaning. Travelers from England who crossed into France at the time were shocked at the poverty they saw. One English traveler, Lady Mary Montagu, wrote of her trip to a French village in 1718 that the whole town came out to beg. With such miserable, starved faces and thin, tattered clothes, they need no eloquence to persuade the wretchedness of their condition. And Simon Black says it was under such wretched conditions that invention and innovation died. French taxes were so high and the people were so miserable that no one had any incentive to develop technology or become more productive. French productivity and agriculture were at least a century behind England, which was already using machinery and advanced crop rotation techniques. The French economy essentially remained in the Dark Ages thanks to the government destroying every incentive to grow. Now, this is a familiar theme throughout history. Governments have a tendency to create terrible conditions and bad incentives that hold back an economy. We can see this everywhere today. And one area in particular is this supposed food crisis that everyone is talking about. Bill Gates, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, the head of the UN World Food Program, Germany's foreign minister, McKinsey and Company, the New York Times, CNN, they're all warning of a food crisis. Even the president of the United States said of food shortages, it's going to be real. Just like the 81 million people who voted for him. Wink, wink. Now, reports of a full-blown food crisis are overstated, says Simon Black. And here's what he means. There is plenty of food in the world, plenty of production. The sun didn't stop shining. The soil wasn't suddenly depleted of its nutrients. Frankly, there are always challenges with food production somewhere in the world every year. Now, just this year, there was a bird flu that wiped out millions of chickens in the United States. Farmers in southern and eastern Ukraine are obviously struggling. But what you probably didn't hear is that Australia had a record wheat harvest this season. Ironically, so did Russia. Brazilian corn production is a near record high 112 million metric tons. Countless fruits, vegetables, and nuts ranging from avocados to olives to walnuts to tomatoes are being produced at or near record quantities. Plus, he says, even if there really were critical problems with food production, there's a vast amount of land in the world that could be planted, especially with seasonal cereal crops like wheat. Now, you might have heard a lot about fertilizer shortages over the past few months. However, the key ingredients in agricultural fertilizers, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, are not in short supply. Nitrogen is one of the most abundant elements in the universe. Literally 80% of the air we breathe is composed of nitrogen. Phosphorus, which comes from phosphate mining, is incredibly abundant in the United States, Brazil, and Morocco. And potassium comes from potash mining, of which Canada has the world's biggest production and reserves. So the bottom line is the world is not lacking any of the ingredients to produce food. But it has definitely become more challenging to move food from farm to fridge, however. He says this system, harvest, packing, inspection, shipping, warehousing, worked well for decades. The global supply chain only broke down recently because of pandemic hysteria, and some of this has undoubtedly affected the food trade. But like France's economic plight in the early 1700s, this is mostly a question of bad government. At its core, there is nothing wrong with the global supply chain. Need convincing? Okay. Consider that Pfizer's been able to produce billions of vaccines, distribute them across the world, and even manage to maintain a temperature of minus 90 degrees centigrade during shipment. You never hear anyone talk about global supply chain problems when it comes to vaccine distribution. But with respect to baby formula in the United States, well, suddenly there's an insurmountable problem with the global supply chain. He says the bottom line is that the global supply chain works, but only when they really want it to work. And their prioritization is utterly disgusting. They could fix all of it. If the government is so concerned about high oil prices, why haven't they fast-tracked new production? If they're so concerned about fertilizer prices, why haven't they fast-tracked permitting for new phosphate mines or potash mines or fertilizer production plants? Whether you chalk it up to them deliberately destroying the economy or just a comical level of incompetence, the results are obvious. And the baby formula fiasco is the perfect example. And that's why it's so interesting to hear Joe Biden say that the food crisis is going to be real, because he seems hell-bent on making it happen. Even more ridiculous are the solutions to this supposed food crisis. We have our techno-aristocracy like Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg who want to reimagine how us peasants should live our lives. They're calling for green revolution, which sounds idealistic until you see what they're actually suggesting. They want to pump our foods full of more chemicals and raise the bar on genetic modification. Gates wants us to eat synthetic beef and alternative protein. And his buddies at the World Economic Forum think we should eat weeds and insects. These people are insane. Simon Black says, fortunately, it's quite easy to distance yourself from their ideas. After all, a lot of our basic foods are super easy to grow. Simple greens like lettuce and cilantro can be planted in a windowsill box and be ready to eat in just a couple of weeks. If you have access to sunlight, a little bit of soil, and a paper cup, you can start taking back control today. That's actually good news, isn't it?
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Welcome back to the show. I want to send a shout out here to HSLAmmo.com. I got a link provided in my show notes. And if you find yourself in need of good, high-quality, new or remanufactured ammo, HSL Ammo is the one I'd point you toward. You know, it hasn't been easy. Speaking of supply chain problems, keeping ammo manufacturing going has been a bit of a challenge. But, man, my friend Spencer Worthington is one of the best and hardest-working individuals I know. He has built, from the ground up, a marvelous ammunition company, provided great employment opportunities for people right there within his community, and he's providing you with a commodity that can do a number of things. It can be a store of value. Some people will invest in ammo as a commodity, understanding that it can be bartered or traded or otherwise sold off, while the dollar continues to depreciate in its purchasing power. Ammo remains valuable. It's also a great way to convert money into skill. And skill at arms is a good thing to have. So thanks again to HSLAmmo.com. I don't know if you caught this yesterday, but former President George W. Bush had a very recent gaffe about a brutal, unjustified invasion. Now, he was talking about Russia and Ukraine. But I want you to hear this in his own words, how this actually played out. This is nothing short of remarkable.
The result is an absence of checks and balances in Russia and the decision of one man to launch a wholly unjustified and brutal invasion of Iraq.
What?
I mean, of Ukraine. Iraq. Anyway. 75.
Wow. I mean, that's just, you know, it's a perfect example of a Freudian slip, I guess. Maybe the most perfect example that's happened in our lifetime. The unconscious is always letting you know what needs the light. One man made a decision to launch a brutal and unjustified invasion. Yeah, well, that guy didn't happen to call himself the decider, did he? I'm just sorry. I know this is opening an old wound for a lot of people, but sometimes you just have to wonder. You just have to wonder about the people who push war as the answer to life's problems. And I'm sorry to say George W. Bush was one of them. I had high hopes when he was elected back in 2000, And that was probably one of the big major turning points for me, was to recognize that, oh, he gave great lip service to the Constitution, but in practice, he trashed it just as quickly as he could following September 11th. And we have been less free every consecutive year since then, not because of the Taliban, not because of Osama bin Laden, not because of Al-Qaeda, but because of what our own government has done. So with that in mind, I want to share with you a commentary from the Z-Man. This is one of my favorite commentators. And he talks about what exactly is going on, how the warmongers among us seem to be losing their minds. The Z-Man says, in America, what's called the political left operates within a few modes of thought tied to seminal events on the left. So one is the civil rights era. Now there's the Watergate era. The other is interwar Europe. And all the events are framed by this period. If they don't fit in these models, then they're usually ignored. Now, of course, their framing of these periods is cartoonish and absurd. It's all easy to understand heroes and villains who are stripped of moral ambiguity and nuance. And what passes for the right has always been an echo of the left, so they've evolved similar framings. It took a while, but the 1980s is one of their primary frameworks for talking about current events. They're always looking for the next Reagan, the next Margaret Thatcher, or Bill Buckley among the current mediocrities. And the answer to almost every issue is a slogan from the high water point of conservatism. Modern conservatism is a cargo cult where current members ape the members of the past. So, like their friends on the left, the right also has an obsession for the interwar period in Europe, but with a different emphasis. While the left checks under their bed every night to make sure Hitler's not waiting for them, the right is always sure Neville Chamberlain is lurking somewhere, ready to give away the Sudetenland. Like the left, their understanding of the time is cartoonish and absurd. All the players are exaggerated heroes or villains with crude moral choices. Now, this is painful to understand, but I think he's right here. This can be traced to the Reagan years. His innovation in the Cold War was to call the Russians the evil empire. This may be the first example of a politician convincing adults by using a reference to a children's show. Everyone dealing with an affluent white female liberal who quotes Harry Potter all the time can thank Ronald Reagan for that bit of cultural innovation. Ever since, the right has sorted the world into extreme villains and themselves as heroes. Now, of course, the most extreme villain is Hitler. Now, Reagan stopped short of calling Gorbachev the new Hitler, but that generation knew their history. Those that followed have thrown around the Hitler language as recklessly as the left. Saddam Hussein was Hitler, and his party was Islamo-fascist. In fact, every Muslim with a complaint about bombs dropping on his head was called an Islamo-fascist by conservatives. Even the Taliban got this label from conservatives. Now, in this framing, every Hitler needs a Chamberlain and Churchill. In conservative framing, Chamberlain is not a man who wished to avoid another horrible European war, but a foolish sissy unwilling to face reality. And Churchill is not a reckless warmonger known for his alcoholism and lack of judgment, but a heroic visionary who could spot old Scratch coming before anyone. Of course, every conservative sees a bit of Churchill in himself, so he's always ready for another war. We see this with the undeclared war on Russia. Putin is Hitler, despite the Russian role in defeating the real Hitler. The Russians are Nazis invading Poland, even though the guys on the other side are extreme Hitler enthusiasts. Biden has to be Chamberlain, even though he barely knows where he is most of the time, and it's his administration that launched the war against Russia. His failure to take it to the nuclear level is proof that he's too soft on the new Hitler. Now, you see this deranged mental state in the American conservative, in this American conservative post, which he links to, about a warmonger convention held in D.C. Those who point out the massive failure of 30 years of pointless wars of choice are now called neo-isolationist. Note how not supporting aggressive imperial wars of domination is isolationism. Note that the people who say this love quoting the founders, except the part where Washington warned about entangling alliances. Now, the Z-Man says part of this framing is lack of scruples by modern conservatives. The warmonger events are sponsored by the war machine, and they pay well. Sites like National Review are wholly dependent on money from big tech and the military-industrial complex, so they're happy to sell endless war, foreign and domestic. Conservatism's now just public relations, the public relations arm of the security state. That's why they never expose themselves to pushback on these issues. That aside, it still leaves the obsession with Hitler. In the middle of the last century, the men who actually fought real Nazis rarely mentioned Hitler. The occasional joke about the old enemies was as much as they did. Their children and now their grandchildren, who grew up insulated from all of life's troubles, are obsessed with events that happened almost a century ago in another country. The war on Russia reveals that this derangement is getting worse. Now, the answer may simply be that so-called conservatives are just boys and girls playing a role wearing costumes too large for them. Like children in their parents' clothes, modern political actors are midgets compared to the men who created the roles they're now asked to play. To make up for the fact that they are fleas on the society they inherited, they exaggerate their role in it. A similar phenomenon drives the left, which also operates like a cargo cult. Another factor is cultural inertia. The global American empire was born in the Second World War, and its evolution was in the context of its shadow. The Cold War was driven by the energy of the war against fascism. The energy from the initial creation of the empire was channeled into the Cold War. The residual energy that now gets channeled into endless wars of choice is just cultural inertia. It's the old rationale for existence looking for a place to go in a post-Cold War age. So the Z-Man says, regardless, the only way forward for America and the West is to finally close the books on the 20th century. That will require a lot of funerals and retirement parties, but Father Time is undefeated in this regard. Once the people defined by the endless fights over old ideas like nationalism, fascism, and communism are gone, then the new fights over civilizationalism can begin. The question is whether the actuarial tables can do their magic before it's too late. Interesting. I have to agree that a lot of this is just, you know, people in power looking for a reason to support that national security state that was created in the most Faustian bargain ever following World War II. And it's not like we haven't been warned along the way. Even President Eisenhower warned about the military-industrial complex and what it was becoming. Hey, that was a long time ago. That was more than 60 years ago. It's not getting better. I guess there's not a lot you and I can do, but awareness is a good start. And refusal to give your consent and your allegiance to such individuals or such movements, I'd say that's probably a pretty important thing as well.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.